Dave Andrew Radio Plays brings you The Whitechapel Murders File. This is an account of the horrible events of 1888, when a killer stalked the streets of London's East End, indiscriminately killing women and leaving a trail of terror in his wake. The Whitechapel Murders File recorded the deaths of 11 women, many of whom are regarded to be the victims of the infamous Jack the Ripper. The stories you are about to hear are real. The characters are real. The events are real. Take a step back in time and hear the stories these poor women never got to tell. The Whitechapel Murders File, Episode 2, Mary Ann Nichols. It is generally considered that the Ripper killed 5 women. Although, as previously mentioned, opinion is, and always shall be, divided about that. The next entry in the file is the first of the so-called canonical 5, a term which was first used by the late author, researcher and scholar Martin Fido in 1987. The lady's name is...
Mary Ann Walker, known as Polly to my friends. I was born on 26th of August, 1845, the middle child of Edward and Caroline Walker. We lived at Dawes Court, Shoe Lane, just off Fleet Street. My dad was a locksmith at first, but he later became a blacksmith, and my mum was a laundress. Our home was really small. It was only about 10 feet by 12 feet, and there was insufficient ventilation and sanitation, which was very hard to live with sometimes, as was the fact that there was absolutely no privacy. I had 2 brothers, Edward and Frederick Joseph, and it was hard to be the only girl. People were always getting sick back then. Cholera was rife and people were dying all around us. Sadly, in the spring of 1852, my mum got very sick. I was so sad and so scared she was going to die. She fought very bravely for weeks, but when she caught tuberculosis as well, her body just couldn't cope anymore. And she passed away on 25th of November, 1852. I'd never known a pain like that before. I was only 7 years old at the time and I didn't truly understand death. It took time for it to sink in. I was never going to see her again. I really needed her and now she was gone. I'm really proud of my dad though. Widowed men in Victorian times were not expected to raise their children alone and it would have been easy for him to put us all in the workhouse, but he was insistent that we all stay together. My auntie, Mary Webb, would often help out, and I'll always be grateful to her for that. With the death of our dear mother still fresh in our minds, we were to suffer another tragedy in April of 1854. My baby brother, Frederick Joseph, caught tuberculosis and passed away. I think Dad must have known he was dying as he had him baptised on the 14th of March, 1854, maybe in preparation. Once again, the dark cloud of despair came over me. And I couldn't understand why those I loved being taken away from me. Frederick Joseph was laid to rest beside our mum at St. Andrew's Church in Holborn. The only comfort I could get was the thought of him lying in her arms once more, that she would keep him safe through eternity. Unlike most of the girls I knew, I was able to stay in school until I was 15 years old, which was not easy as I had to combine my studies with my household chores. Losing mum and Frederick Joseph left a big hole in our family. None of us was ever the same again after they died, but we did our best to carry on. When I was just 18 years old, I married a printer's machinist named William Nichols at St. Bride's Parish Church in the City of London, and we moved into a home in Bouverie Street, another road off Fleet Street. At some point, we left this home and moved in with my dad at his address, 131 Trafalgar Road, Walworth, London. I gave birth to our first son, who we called William Edward Nichols, on 17th of December, 1864. Sadly, he wasn't strong enough to live, and he perished shortly after being born. I was overwhelmed by a different sort of pain this time, this little life which I'd felt growing inside me, giggling at the little kicks. I just wanted to go to sleep and never wake up again when we lost him. I felt so isolated. I needed to speak to somebody about how I was feeling inside, looking for reassurance from them. It was not really the done thing for people to share their emotions back then, so I had to suffer in silence. I miss my mum more than ever now. How I needed to feel her arms around me, have her cradle me whilst I cried. Losing my baby was to have the most profound effect on me. I never got over the loss and I struggled to come to terms with it. I'd take a drink every now and again to help ease the pain. I should have realised that no amount of self-medication can ever cure the darkness you feel inside. It only masks it, makes matters worse. Blessings can occur, even in your darkest of hours. And on the 4th of July, 1866, our son Edward John Nichols was born, a fine and healthy boy. It seemed like all the bad luck was behind us when we went on to have Percy George Nichols in 1868, Alice Esther Nichols in 1870, Eliza Sarah Nichols in 1877, and Henry Alfred Nichols in 1879. I was a wife and a mother, caring for my family in our new home on the newly established Peabody Estate, Stamford Street, Southwark. Families who lived on the Peabody Estate were really lucky. There were inside toilets, no more shivering in the dark in a dirty and freezing outhouse at the end of the garden. We had to share this with our neighbour, but it was luxury compared to what we'd been used to. There were bathing facilities on the ground floor, hot water to wash yourself in and keep yourself clean. There was even a place to wash your clothes, and more importantly, a place to dry them where they would not be contaminated by the foul smell of smog or sewage. I'd never imagined I could find such a good place to live. The building had a superintendent who'd make sure you were abiding by all the rules. Not everybody was lucky enough to be offered accommodation with Peabody. You had to qualify, which fortunately we did, and you had to maintain those standards whilst living in one of their flats, ours being flat 3, D block. I loved it there. It felt very much like home for a while. I was still taking a drink now and again, but it was after Henry Alfred was born. It got a lot worse. I noticed that William was becoming less attentive towards me and more attentive towards our neighbour, Rosetta Wells. I was probably also suffering from postnatal depression, and I knew William would not be much of a comfort with this, so I drank more heavily than I did before. I began to feel trapped, and I needed to get out. I left the flat on a number of occasions to stay elsewhere. I just needed to get out of the situation, but I couldn't never stay away from my children for long. I knew that this was upsetting William, and I knew that his affection for me was dying, but I couldn't change what I was doing. In the end, we had to give up our lovely flat. I moved back in with my dad, whilst William kept the children with him when he moved to another home, which I think was close to the Old Kent Road. This was in 1880. William told people that the marriage had ended because of my constant drinking, but I think it was because he had fallen in love with somebody else. Some people say he fell for the midwife who delivered Henry Alfred, but I think it was with our neighbour, Rosetta Wells. This is something which he denied. He claimed that no affair started until after we had become estranged. In any case, he was ordered to pay me 5 shillings a week. To my shame, I ended up knocking on the doors of the Lambeth Workhouse near Elephant and Castle in London. I had nowhere else to go, and I was destitute. I hated having to live there. I didn't have enough money to rent a room or even pay the 4 pence a night for a filthy bed in a dirty lodging house. I stayed at the workhouse until 31st of May, 1881, when I left to see if I could find another way to live. Life was very hard for me. I was missing my children so much and the home I used to share with them. I was missing William, although I knew he'd moved on with his life and didn't want me to be a part of it. My dependency on drink was just as bad. It was the only comfort I could find, no matter how cold that comfort was to be. I had to concede defeat and return to the workhouse on 24th of April, 1882. It was, as always, a last resort, but I had no other option at that time. I stayed with them until 24th of March, 1883, when I left to move in with my father at Trafalgar Road. My alcohol addiction was out of control. I knew it really upset my dad when I'd get drunk and confrontational. We had a big row about my drinking, so I left the house on 21st of May, 1883, and returned to Lambeth Workhouse. It was the lowest point of my life. I was estranged from all those I loved and had to find my own life on the toughest streets in London. I met a man named Thomas Dew and found him really nice, like him a lot. I lived with him for a while and it felt so good to have somebody to go home to, somebody to hold me and care about me again. When William found out that I was living with another man, he stopped paying the 5 shillings a week he'd been ordered to. I really needed that money, but he suggested that I was living immorally and that he should not have to pay for me anymore. I petitioned through the parish council, but I never got another penny from him. My relationship with Thomas didn't last, and I found myself on a cycle of living between workhouses, doss houses, or on the street. On the 24th of October, 1887, I was one of hundreds of people who protested at Trafalgar Square, which the authorities hated us for. We'd all decided to bring attention to the plight of homeless people by camping out at this popular landmark with supporters giving speeches and rallying people. Felt really good to be amongst like-minded people, people who all understood what you were going through and didn't stand in judgment on you for how you were forced to live. I was one of many people who were arrested under the vagrancy law, and I was determined I wouldn't go quietly to my incarceration. I fought back and I screamed out my displeasure along with some words I could never repeat to you whilst I was being dragged towards the Maria. I don't know if my actions nor the actions of all else who gathered there was to make a difference. All I do know is that people will talk about that day for many years to come. Good fortune shone at me at last when I was once again living in the workhouse. The matron had found me a job as a living housekeeper for the Cowdrey family, who lived over the river in Wandsworth, southwest London. I'll always remember the place and the awe I felt upon seeing it for the first time. It was a house called Ingleside, 26 Rose Hill Road, SW18. They were good, God-fearing people and very nice to me. I was given my own room and clothing and the work was never too hard. I wanted to share my good fortune with my dad. Although we'd argued, we'd never lost our relationship for long and he was the only one I wanted to tell about my good luck. I just write to say you'll be glad to know that I'm settled in my new place and going on all right up to now. My people went out yesterday and haven't returned, so I'm in charge. It's a grand place inside with trees and gardens back and front. All has been newly done up. They are teetotalers and religious, so I ought to get on. They're very nice people. And I haven't too much to do. Hope you're all right. And the boy has work. So goodbye for the present from yours truly, Polly. Answer soon, please, and let me know how you are. My eldest, Edward John, was living with him at the time. I was hoping he'd found work and he was happy and healthy. I missed him so very much. I was also hoping that Dad and I could start to communicate more. I must have needed him in my life a lot more than I realised. The Cowdreys were teetotal and very much against alcohol. I was still very much in need of it, and over time this became a problem for me. I didn't want to lose the good fortune I'd found, but I couldn't give up drinking. I decided that it would be fairer to leave the job and house behind and return to where I felt safest. I left the house whilst the family were out. I took some clothing with me, which I don't think they'd miss. Maybe, if times got really hard, I could sell some off it to pay for my board. I left Ingleside on 12th of July, 1888, and made my way to Spitalfields, East London, where I took up lodgings at 18 Thrall Street. On the 30th of August, 1888, I was enjoying an evening out at the Frying Pan pub at the junction of Thrall Street and Brick Lane. After I'd finished my last drink, I walked to 18 Thrall Street in the hopes of getting a bed for the night. I didn't have the required 4 pence, so I was turned away. I was not overly upset by this, and I remember joking with the deputy housekeeper that I would soon get my money, joking with him, "See what a jolly bonnet I've got now." I was, I suppose, quite tipsy at this stage, but I was not drunk. I wandered around for a while, must have met up with some acquaintances, because I was given more to drink, and I did end up drunk after that. I must also have been given some DOS money, because I remember using it to buy some drink with it. By the time I left, wherever it was I'd been, I was totally drunk. It was the same night that a big fire broke out in a spirits warehouse at the East India Docks. It had taken hours for the fire to be brought under control, and although I didn't see it for myself, I met with my friend, Emily Holland, who had. She was making her way back to 18 Thrall Street when I bumped into her, and I remember having to support myself against the shutters of a grocer's shop as I was unsteady on my feet. Emily said, "Come back with me, I'll get you a bed." I told her that I had my lodging money 3 times over today, but I've spent it. I assured her I wouldn't be long and carried on walking towards Whitechapel Road. It's from here that everything becomes a bit of a blur. I was wandering around until I found myself at Buck's Row. I was so tired and my legs were aching, so I sat down and rested my back against some wooden gates. It was not my intention to stay there long, but I was so sleepy, just wanted to close my eyes. I thought I heard somebody coming towards me, but I couldn't open my eyes to see who it might be. I then felt a hand clasp in my face and the pressure of a sharp object tear into my throat, after which there was no more sound, no more fear, and no more pain.
A carman by the name of Charles Allen Cross, also known as Lechmere, was on his way to work at about 3:30 a.m., his route taking him along Bucks Row on his way to Liverpool Street. He was walking along the right-sided pavement and noticed a bundle lying in a gateway on the opposite side of the street. He approached, thinking that it may be a discarded tarpaulin which he could use for work, but found it was the body of a woman. He heard footsteps and turned to see a man, another carman by the name of Robert Paul, walking towards him. It is interesting to note that Paul told the subsequent inquest that when he had initially seen Cross standing in the middle of the road, he tried to avoid him, fearing that he would be mugged. He said that Cross put a hand on his shoulder and said,
"Come and look over here. There's a woman lying on the pavement."
After which both men went over to Polly Nichols. Cross touched her face and stated that it was still warm, whilst Paul felt for a heartbeat, which he believed he had found.
"I think she's breathing, but very little if she is."
Paul suggested that they should sit Polly up, but Cross refused to touch her for a second time and said that they should find the nearest police officer and tell him what they had found. They were both concerned that they would be late for work also, so they left her as she was, putting her raised skirt down to give her a little dignity before they left.
It was to transpire later that Cross, also known as Lechmere, would be named as a late suspect for being the Ripper himself, and that he was not the first to discover the body. He was responsible for it being there. Upon hearing Paul's footsteps, he ceased what he was doing and made up the story that he had innocently found her lying there. It should be remembered that Paul's initial reaction to him was one of distrust and suspicion. So, could it be that Charles Allen Lechmere was, in fact, the man we have come to know as Jack the Ripper? PC John Meal was on foot patrol that morning and walked into Bucks Row, Whitechapel, at about 3:40 a.m., moments after Cross and Paul left. In the arc of his lantern, he saw an object lying on the pavement and went over to investigate. What he saw was to shock him to the core. With the benefit of illumination, he could see that blood was oozing from her throat, which had been slashed twice from left to right. He heard the footsteps of his colleague, PC Thane, who was passing by the entrance to Bucks Row. Upon seeing PC Neal's flashing lantern, he went to join him. PC Neal asked Thane to fetch Dr. Llewellyn, the police surgeon, who arrived at Bucks Row around 4 a.m, quickly pronouncing life extinct and determining, by the fact that her legs were still warm, that Polly had been dead for approximately 30 minutes. He ordered that the body be removed to the old Montague Street mortuary, where a post-mortem could be performed to determine the cause of death. Unceremoniously, Polly Nichols was bundled into a handcart and removed from Bucks Row.
Inspector Spracklin was on Hackney Road when he was told about the murder, and he made his way directly to the scene, where residents were washing away the blood. He was told that her body was now at the mortuary on Old Montague Street, so he made his way there. He noticed the obvious wounding to Polly's throat, but upon further inspection, he found the mutilation to her abdomen and immediately sent for Dr. Llewellyn. In complete contradiction to the preserving of evidence, two men, Robert Mann and James Hatfield, described as being senile workhouse paupers, had stripped Polly of all of her clothing and were washing the body. This action was later criticised by the coroner. Llewellyn discovered that there was bruising to both sides of her face, either caused by a fist or the pressure of a thumb, prior to her throat being cut twice, from left to right. One of these wounds measured 8 inches in length, whilst the other measured 4 inches. Both wounds were deep enough to reach the vertical column. Two stab wounds were found in her vaginal region, and her abdomen had been mutilated. One deep, jagged wound found 2 to 3 inches on her left side, with several further incisions found across her abdomen, causing her bowels to protrude through the wounds. 3 or 4 cuts were also found running down the right side of her body, considered by Llewelyn to have been caused by the same knife, which he deemed to be at least 6 to 8 inches long. No organs were missing from Polly Nichols. Llewelyn believed that she was facing her killer when the fatal wound was inflicted, suggesting that the Ripper would have put his hand across her mouth prior to cutting her throat. Death, he believed, would have been instantaneous, and the mutilation carried out after she had died. There was speculation as to the actual location of the murder. Such an atrocity should have resulted in vast blood loss, but only a little was found at the scene. PC Thane, when helping to lift Polly onto the cart, had his hands covered in her blood, which led people to believe that her clothing had absorbed most of her blood. The tenements along Bucks Row were densely populated, and it is thought that one of the residents suffered with insomnia and used to pace around her room at all hours of the night. Whilst the street was dimly lit, could it be possible that such a violent murder took place and nobody heard or saw it happen?
When we think about the sad life and awful death of Mary Ann Nichols, are we to believe the prejudices and condemnations of the past? The hearsay of Grub Street's finest and overall assumptions of the law, who pigeonholed all unfortunate women as prostitutes? What proof is there that Polly was selling herself for sex? It's an assumption without foundation, and it's easier to think of her in those terms because it fits somebody else's narrative. In today's world, there would have been help available to her and a lot more understanding of her addiction and the circumstances which led to it. As a young girl, she nursed and watched her mother die of a horrendous disease, and then had to grow up very quickly to become the woman of the house, along with trying to obtain an education. Here was a young bride who did her best for her family, suffering the tragedy of sudden infant death syndrome and never being given any help to cope with such a painful loss. As a working class woman in the Victorian age, she would never have had much. But what she had, she would have treasured. And no mother would willingly walk away from her children easily. They would not live without feeling the guilt of it every single day, the feeling of loss every single day, and without the regret of doing so. She found solace and comfort in the arms of another man. So yes, she could be seen as an adulterer, but so was her husband. And yet very few arrows have been shot in his direction. Committing adultery with one man does not class you as a prostitute. As it was then, is now, and always will be, alcoholism is an illness, not a choice, and judgments will always be clouded when dictated by need.
Polly Nichols was buried on the afternoon of the 6th of September 1888 in the City of London Cemetery, her body being transported there in a hearse provided by Hanbury Street undertaker Henry Smith. 2 mournful coaches followed the coffin, wherein sat Edward Walker, William Nichols, and 3 of Polly's children. Several thousand people lined the route to the cemetery, observing silently as Polly was taken to her final resting place, a sad end.